You're listening to Trek FM.
Hey guys, this is Mike.
This is Max.
We are the host of Commentary, Trek Stars. And before we get this episode started, we just wanted to say that we are finalists for the Parsec Awards. Are you familiar with the Parsec Awards?
I'm familiar with the term Parsec. Mm-hmm. And yes, I know about the Parsec Awards.
Okay. It's a celebration of speculative fiction podcasting. And we are finalists in the Best Speculative Fiction Fan or News Podcast Specific category. And, you know, we just thought that that was pretty cool. And we just wanted to sort of make note of that. And we have no chance in hell of winning because we're up against Rebel Force Radio.
Well, we don't talk about Star Wars or Doctor Who, which is why I think that we should introduce a segment into all of our episodes where we compare the episodes and stuff we're talking about with our favorite episodes of Doctor Who and our favorite Star Wars movies.
It's an option. It's an option. I don't know at this stage in the game whether or not it would help our cause, but yeah, I mean, we are definitely the
I have a pretty good fat Dalek voice.
We are definitely the underdogs here. We're going up against. There you go. See, if we had done that earlier, we might have had a better shot at winning. But as it stands, we're up against Rebel Force Radio, which I'm pretty sure is the number one Star Wars show. And we're also up against Doctor Who Radio Free Scarrow, which I'm pretty sure is the number one Doctor Who show. And we're up against two other Doctor Who shows, which are way more popular than ours. So, yeah. We're definitely going to try to go down to Dragon Con and be there for the ceremony, and there's no shot of us winning. But if we had won, if we were to win, we would say thanks to Chris Jones for letting us actually do this show, and we'd say thanks to Drew Stewart for pushing for us to do the show and also pushing for the show to be on the network. And we'd also say thanks to our significant others for letting us do the show in the first place. So yeah, we'll keep you posted, but yeah. And if you're at Dragon Con,
I'm gonna start a new con called Dragon Han.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone has to dress like Han Solo.
Okay.
And ride a dragon.
And if you're at Dragon Con, take a look for us or let us know if you're there. Tweet us or something.
Yes, we may both be there.
We may both be there. We hopefully will both be there.
Yeah.
All right. On with the show. Hello and welcome to Season 2, Episode 12 of Commentary, Trek Stars, a show which deals with the work of Star Trek creators outside of Star Trek. Today is part 4 in our look at Richard Matheson as a writer of books that were turned into movies. And today's book is his 4th book, The Shrinking Man. I'm Mike.
I'm Max.
And today we're joined by our friend Matt. How's it going, Matt?
Pretty good. Thanks for having me on the show.
Yeah, well, thanks for coming. So, without you, Matt, there may not be a Commentary Trek Stars because you're the one who convinced me to watch Star Trek 2, 3, and 4 after watching Star Trek 1 and not being impressed.
Way to go, Matt.
Well, I mean, to be fair.
Made a monster.
Starting with 1. I mean, who does that?
I really? Guess that is kind of weird.
Mathematicians. Oh, no, wait, they start with 0. Never
there
mind.
You go.
Never mind.
What about you? How did you get interested in Star Trek?
Well, I think I watched Star Trek 2 when I was at my uncle and aunt's place. They had it on Laserdisc.
Awesome.
So it might have been then. I can't remember, though.
What about Richard Matheson?
You know, I didn't know that he wrote books. I didn't know that who he was or anything like that until you happened to say, hey, we're doing this thing. Why don't you read the book and join us?
All right, well, today's book is The Shrinking Man, which was his 4th book. It was written in 1956, 2 years after I Am Legend. And Max, would you like to give a synopsis of The Shrinking Man? Spoilers, as always.
Sure. There's this guy who's on a boat with his wife, and he gets sprayed with some radioactive mist but it reacts to some pesticide that he inhaled earlier, and that makes him start shrinking, which is crazy because that doesn't happen in science.
Okay. So, Matt, what were your thoughts on the book?
Well, you know, I have to be fair. I cheated.
You don't have to be fair.
No, I do. I have to be honest. I cheated. You I read really about 100 pages, and I'm like, oh, my goodness, this whole book is just moaning and groaning, blah, 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 blah. Why would I want to sit here and read another 100 pages of blah, 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 moan, 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 oh, my life sucks, wah. So I flipped, and I read the last chapter of the book. I rarely ever do that. And I was like, oh, my goodness, you didn't just do that. Oh. So in the end, what happens is he shrinks down to nothing. Well, but
no,
indeed, he's not nothing.
Yeah.
Because apparently shrinking 1/7 of an inch every day is not accurate, because then he shrank from 1/7 of an inch down to the microscopic, which isn't 1/7 of an inch. So if I would expect scientists to be able to actually measure in a reasonable amount of precision and accuracy to of small values, they wouldn't say, oh, you shrink 1/7 of an inch. They might say, oh, you shrink about 1/7 of an inch, or a slightly less than 1/7 of an inch. Whatever. So,
but he's never going to become negative 1/7 of an inch tall.
Right. But if you're shrinking and you're always shrinking a constant value, you're going to go from 1/7 to maybe just shy of zero. But then the next day, poof, you turn into zero.
But that doesn't mean that he would cease to exist when he gets to less than 1/7 of an inch.
Well, what would happen then?
Well, I think what would happen is what happens at the end of the book, where he becomes some other kind of size entirely.
Okay.
See, but in the description of the book, no. I mean, he is actually not 1/7 of an inch. He's larger than zero. He's not at he's at the microscopic level. But I mean, that's totally inconsistent with anything else that has happened.
I do not think that that is a problem any more than every other thing having to do with him shrinking. I can't believe that the problem that you're having is the mathematics of the amount of his shrinking.
That's the most blatant, because they spell it out. They set up rules.
But it's not the most blatant. Everything in the story has ridiculous science to it.
Well, yeah.
The descriptions of objects vary wildly in terms of what scale things are.
Well, that's just a perception. I can ignore that.
Okay, but regardless, either way, it doesn't work. The science in it is problematic at best. But this is a problem which is unique to the book, and you know the reason why they did it is obviously so that they could have that fake at the end, where you know the whole time he thinks he's going to be turning into nothing, and then at the end he doesn't, which I think is kind of dumb. So on the whole, Matt, did you like the book or not?
Yeah, I did. I thought that the format was kind of interesting. So the format of the book is each chapter starts off with the current time, you know, when he's less than 1 inch tall. And then at some point, something jogs his memory and he remembers a time when he was larger. And it sort of scales down all the way to the point where, at the end of the book, his memory is back where he's starting the book.
Yeah.
So, and I found that format kind of interesting. I thought that it segued well between the two. But the only problem that I had with it was that he was angry for the first half of the book, both in memory and in current time. And then, by the time he gets to the second half of the book, he starts having hope. And surprisingly enough, he has hope back when he was in his memory as well as current time. And that seems to strike me as being weird, that he would start off as being angry and then get hope and then get angry again.
I didn't have a problem with that structure so much, because it, in a sense, is broken up into two parts. You know, there's the part before he was in the cellar and the part while he was in the cellar.
Right.
And, you know, his life was different at both those times. So, I don't know. I did really like the structure too. It was kind of similar to, well, I mean, there's a ton of books and movies and everything that do that. Reservoir Dogs comes to mind, mm-hmm. where you have like sort of this big event, but you're constantly flashing back to what happened, you're thrown into it. And then over the course of the story, you catch up to where you were at the beginning and you find out what was going on.
Yeah, I like that format. As I said, I like the format of the book. I thought it was good because it showed you both sides of the situation, you know.
I think you're talking to the attitude.
Yeah, the attitude that he had. It seemed like there was nothing that would cause him to lose his hope all of a sudden.
I think the reason that it like sort of oscillates between like, you know, the hope for a reversal or some sort of like return to normality and the frustration that it isn't is sort of because that's how it's going on in his head. Because every few minutes, like that little wall of denial that he's built up gets shattered and he becomes frustrated again.
But that's what I'm trying to say. There's a point in the book when he meets Clarice and he sleeps with her and then he goes back. He's turned over a new leaf and he's totally hopeful. So he's decided I'm in charge of my life regardless of what it is. And then again, he decides that when he makes the I'm going to kill this spider. I'm going to get the bread and I'm going to kill this spider no matter what because I'm a man. He decides that. So at those two points, he's decided, okay, he's turned over a new leaf and things are the way that they are, but he's going to take whatever abilities he has and he's going to use them to live his life to its fullest, whatever that might be. So you have these two points where he suddenly gains hope, or in the second case, it's like, no, I haven't gained hope. I've grown content with the world. Okay, I'm not happy, but I'm content. Okay, fine. I can understand the distinction. But there's these points. There's these two points where he's suddenly going from anger and frustration with the situation and anger. But then there's nothing that would cause him to lose that hope and contentment once he gets into the cellar.
I totally disagree. Every time he became incredibly frustrated and lost hope, there was a catalyst. There was something that instigated it. And it happens a few times. So, I mean, like, it's true. It does sort of like oscillate between those two things. But like, it is always like preceded by at least some sort of indication that his current state is not going to last.
Well, Max, what did you think about the book in general?
I don't really get into these shrinking stories. The science of it, I have way too many problems with the science of it to be concerned with the amount of shrinkage per day. But the sort of like the metaphorical relationship of the narrative is somewhat painfully obvious because it's so obviously like, I'm a white guy in the 50s, and all these people are trying to take away my supremacy of the society at hand, and I don't really feel comfortable with that, and I don't know how I'm going to deal with it. I feel like I'm becoming marginalized, or, you know, shrinking. And then that ends up making the character seem kind of like an archetype for an entire group of somewhat overprivileged bigots. And that gets a little frustrating at times, but the subtextual connotation doesn't really take away from how terrifying that would be. And all of his sort of like, you know, his accidents, his calamities, the terrible things that occur to him after he begins shrinking are essentially as a result of him trying to get back what he had. And it only starts going well for him when he accepts what's happening.
I did not like this book. It had some problems with just being rather boring. There seems to be the two halves of the book that they keep on cutting back and forth between are, you know, the the stuff in the cellar and the stuff before the cellar. And, you know, I just saw an interview with Matheson, and he was talking about how, you know, the idea originally was to do it all chronologically. And he decided to split up the structure, I think mainly because he didn't want to have all of this exposition up front. The problem with that to me is the exposition, the stuff pre-seller, while not tremendously good, is way better than the stuff in the cellar. You know, in the cellar, it becomes sort of like an action story. And something that I've noticed in all three books that we've read so far is Matheson is not very good at writing action. You know, I mean, the action itself, you know, may be fine when translated to the screen, for example. What, you know, the actual action beats are fine. The problem is that he doesn't know how to, like, physically write it. I mean, and this one was just so unbelievably frustrating because he's trying to explain how what these things are from, you know, an inch tall person's perspective. So you've got him trying to explain, you know, what a lawn chair is, but then also trying to explain it from a different scale. And it's just like, I'm having enough trouble following the action. Now you're using all of these clever words and everything to describe a lawn chair. And it's like, this is not working, you know, and then it's just incredibly boring and frustrating, and I don't care about this. So what about the movie? The first one, The Incredible Shrinking Man, was made a year after the book was published. It was written by Matheson himself and directed by a guy named Jack Arnold, who's probably best known for directing Creature from the Black Lagoon. Max, what did you think about the movie?
I can't stand this movie. Okay. Everything about the book that I am able to appreciate is removed mercilessly.
What, like the pedophilia?
Like the pedophilia, like the sexual scenes that are occasional in the book, like the kid. The kid's just not there.
Well, to be fair, she doesn't really play a big role in the book either.
No, but the idea that there's a kid, the idea that he's a father, is sort of a part of like the whole thing. The idea that the kid is bigger than him and more powerful than him, that's significant. And the removal of that, it seems like most of the things that were removed for the purposes of making the movie were removed simply to make the movie and the experience of the protagonist more palatable. Because the idea that he is shrinking gradually is pretty horrifying when you take it seriously, but when you play it as, you know, an alternative arena for action, it ends up being really tedious. And that's why I don't have a problem with the action in the book, because I think it's not really so much like action sequences as it is like peril sequences.
What about you, Matt?
I thought that the book was good. I mean, it wasn't excellent book, but I thought that the movie was a lot worse. I mean, I feel like it portrayed the main events of the book just fine, but I think you lost a lot of the interesting aspects of the book. I mean, what made the book so interesting was his introspection and his dealing with this frustration. Like, so the pedophilia bit, like,
yeah, that needs to be there.
Well, I mean, it kind of does, because it expresses in yet another way his frustration of his inability to express himself sexually. Mm-hmm. Okay. And that was totally lost in the movie completely.
Oh yeah. It was just too uncomfortable.
So, I mean, I feel like the interesting aspects, the intellectually interesting aspects of the books were not discussed at all in the movie. And it was just okay, well, there's this guy and he's shrinking. Oh, he's angry, blah, blah, blah. He lives in a dollhouse, meets a girl, blah, blah, blah. But, I mean, nothing happens, really. He's just, there is somebody my size. Okay, well, fine. I'm going to hang out with her. I'm going to talk with her. She doesn't pity me. I shouldn't pity myself. Okay, blah, blah, blah. I'm going to write my memoirs. Blah, blah, blah. Oh, suddenly I have to fight off a cat and I get stuck down in the cellar. And then I have to fight a tarantula instead of a black widow. So I feel like the movie really did nothing
I did not like the movie either, although I did think it was better than the book because I think it solved a lot of the problems that the book had in terms of telling the story.
Yeah, I would agree. I would agree. The movie told the story better than the book told the story. For instance, they ignore the whole 1/7 of an inch thing. Mm-hmm. He's just growing in spurts, yeah. Or shrinking in spurts, sorry. And that's totally fine. Okay, well, then that makes sense. Okay, suddenly he's 1/7 of an inch. Oh, no, he's suddenly smaller than that. Okay, fine, I can live with that. But it just left a lot of the intellectually interesting material at the door.
What's the point of telling the story if you're not going to tell those parts of it?
Right, if you're not going to tell the interesting part of it, yeah. Then...
Yeah, well, as someone who didn't find the book interesting to begin with, you know, I didn't really have a problem with that. I mean, I think that the action played a lot better. I think that, you know, the explanation for how he got into the cellar in the first place made a lot more sense. And also, it worked better from the wife's perspective because, you know, they actually thought that he was dead instead of just like, he's gone, you know, kind of thing. You know, there's that, I don't know. The stuff with the wife in the book really was problematic to me because it didn't really feel like she missed him. Like she thought he was dead. There was no closure there for her. You know, it really just felt like, well, he's gone.
Well, and we to be honest, we don't know what she was feeling.
That's true.
In the book, because once he disappears, I mean, he said they searched for me for hours, yeah. Even after it went dark.
Yeah.
They were looking and looking and looking.
And there is mention of them believing he's dead.
I guess so.
Like, he hears yeah. them say that.
Yeah.
So, I mean, like, it is basically the same.
Still, I don't know. To me, like...
I can't imagine somebody liking the movie more than the book.
I don't like them either. But, I mean, I did think that the movie was made better. But that's I'm not gonna defend the movie because it's not good. Either. All right. Well, 24 years later, the book was adapted again into a movie, this time The Incredible Shrinking Woman, as suggested by the novel, it says in the credits. This one was directed by Joel Schumacher and stars Lily Tomlin as the shrinking woman. And it is a much more comedic approach and takes a lot more liberties. But at the same time, I was surprised by how much of the book remained intact. You know, the basic story is there. They just change, you know, the setting and stuff like that, the tone and everything. Max, what do you think about The Incredible Shrinking Woman?
That movie I saw when I was a fairly young kid, and I hated it then, and I have no interest in revisiting it at any point. Although I do think it's funny that it was directed by Joel Schumacher, and I never thought of it before, but it does make sense that a guy would like that would be interested in doing a sequel to a previously existing thing and making it dumb and silly and hopefully funny, but not really funny.
For those who don't know, Joel Schumacher is also the director of Batman Forever and Batman and Robin. What about you, Matt? What did you think of The Incredible Shrinking Woman?
I think in some ways it worked better, but... In some ways, it didn't work at all. For instance, one of the key aspects of the book is, which was not touched upon in the movie, by the way, was the fact that the family was going to be losing its sole breadwinner. It also you didn't really get the feeling that the mother lost control of the world. Like vis-a-vis with her kids. I mean, there was that one scene where she was trying to convince them to do something, and then she ha 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 falls into the closet and gets hugged by a teddy bear and stuff or a robot.
Yeah.
So I guess the way that I think of the movie as being better than the book, because it doesn't try to be the book. It just uses this one basic idea. Okay, there's somebody who's shrinking. What kind of a situation could this be? It's a comedic idea. Okay, ha ha ha, some funny things happen. But really, it's changed so much. I mean, they bring in, like, some animal rights type stuff, you know, with the monkeys and the gorilla. But the core ideas and thought experiment of, okay, there's a shrinking person that was discussed in the book and then ignored in the movie was totally blatantly just removed entirely and not even tried to come be brought up in The Incredible Shrinking Woman, the remake. And I think that's okay. I mean, if that's what they wanted to do, then that's fine. But
I know what you're talking about, and I actually think there's kind of possibly an interesting and de facto improving subtext to the lack of the sort of the terrestrial normal drama of the shrinking person. By removing that aspect of it, the subtext of The Incredible Shrinking Woman is essentially, yeah, but it's not really a big deal. Just the unintentional, unintended subtext of removing those real world problems from the equation, I think actually has a positive effect on it, because the sort of black comedy of, so what, she's shrinking, it's not like it really matters, has an interesting subtext. That might be the only saving grace for that movie.
I guess you could say they updated it for the times, and you know, that's perfectly reasonable. I think the problem with this movie is that it's very, very poorly executed. The humor all falls flat. Everything is so, you know, stylized and over the top that you know, if you can't embrace the world that they're creating, then
we're talking about The Incredible Shrinking Woman, not the Batman franchise.
Yeah, but I think that this suffers more than that. But I mean, it really is kind of like that. It is like the Batman Forever of The Incredible Shrinking Man. Yeah. You know, I was surprised at how many like big names from the era, or at least like you know, well respected names from the era, were involved in this. You had Lily Tomlin, Ned Beatty, Charles Grodin. But ultimately, I couldn't stand the movie. I thought it was really, really problematic. Now, believe it or not, in February, it was announced that MGM is remaking The Incredible Shrinking Man. And the script, at least at the time, was being written by Richard Matheson, along with his son, Richard Matheson Jr., he said that it was going to be, you know, an update essentially for the modern era. They talked about, you know, using modern technology, you know, bringing that into play, like nanotechnology and stuff, and having that be a part of it. I don't know. I don't know if this thing is still getting made. I'm assuming it is. It's supposed to come out in 2015. I don't think they have a director or anything attached to it. I'm assuming that the script has been written, because usually when they announce like this person is writing this thing, that usually means this person has turned in the first draft, you know? So it's quite possible that we will see another Incredible Shrinking Man movie, once again written by Richard Matheson, in a couple of years. It was also almost made into a movie a couple years ago by Brett Ratner, who wanted Eddie Murphy to star in it. And that was going to be a comedy version about a magician who turns himself small accidentally or something. I don't know. So Matt, any final thoughts on The Shrinking Man?
Yeah, I would say if you want to pick up a short book that has some interesting ideas, and you can overlook some things, yeah, pick it up. It's a pretty quick read, and it can give you some interesting ideas, much more so than the movies. Don't bother watching the movies.
What about you, Max?
This is not a Matheson story that I think is particularly high on my list of Matheson things. I would say that if you enjoyed the various Twilight Zone episodes and the various movies that have been based on his things, then it seems to make sense to at least explore this, because it is interesting how it sort of prefigures some of his later writing tendencies and his interest in the science fictional exploration of sociological events. It's interesting how both this and I Am Legend deal with a particular kind of change and a transition of the white male in America.
All right. Yeah, I did not like this book at all. I would say it's definitely the worst of the three that we've read so far. And I think that the movies are not good or worth watching either. Although I'd say that The Shrinking Man was better than The Shrinking Woman. Although I am looking forward to this remake. I'm curious to see how Matheson would choose to update the story, given a 56-year gap or 57-year gap in between when he originally wrote it and now. So that could be cool. So Matt, anything you want to promote? Anything that anywhere people can find you on the internet? You're not on Twitter, are you?
I'm not on the internet. Completely backwards in that regard.
Which is weird, considering the fact that you have a degree in computer sciences.
Yes.
But whatever. Okay. Well, as always, you can find us on our website, commentarytrackstars.com, where you can find various audio commentaries for various movies, including a couple which Matt has joined us for, like Star Trek III, The Search for Spock. And you can find us on Twitter at ComTrackStars or email us at ComTrackStars@gmail.com. You can also go to Trek.fm and leave some feedback either on the forums or on the page or whatever. We will be back next week with our friend Rudra to talk about A Stir of Echoes.